We waited just for you.
Sorry, I got called into work.
And you can leave that.
Recording's on.
Okay, we'll call the planning commission meeting Monday, October 14th, 2013, to order. Paul, could you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Christensen?
Here.
Mr. Demarest?
Here.
Mr. Dirksen?
Here.
Mr. Jensen? I've not heard. Commissioner Rodland?
Here.
Mr. Sherwood?
Here.
And Commissioner Tuttle?
Here.
Thank you, Paul. Now is the time we set aside for comments from citizens. Any citizens can sign up. I don't know if we had a sign-up sheet tonight or not. I didn't see any sign-up. Is there anybody that'd like to make a comment that is not on tonight's agenda? I don't see any hands, so let's move on to next item is approval of minutes. I've been informed by Paul that we have no minutes to approve tonight. So we're going to move on to the workshop. And we're going to change the order from the what's on the agenda a little bit. And we're going to start, we'll start with the East Monroe Economic Development Plan. And then we're going to do the school mitigation fees after that. So we got CPA 2011-01, East Monroe Economic Development Group.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
The record should reflect that Mr. Jensen is right.
Okay. Paul, Mr. Jensen has a...
Now he looks at twice.
Thank you, Commissioner Demarest. Okay, then, Paul, then we'll start with the East Monroe.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a PowerPoint, and you have copies that deals with each of these three amendments. I brought for all of these tonight to begin considering these and cumulatively all together. We have some workshops to do that exercise. A word about schedule with a change. We do have workshops tonight and in 2 weeks on the 28th. We had originally planned to hold a public hearing on the 28th, but we had some issues with noticing, and we now need to move that to November 11th. That is actually a city holiday, but you know, most normal people don't get that day off, so we will hold a meeting on a regular meeting date of November 11th. If that works for everybody. And then we're going to be looking for a recommendation to forward to council on the November 25th. So we'll have a couple of workshops, a public hearing, and some opportunity for discussion there, and then action by the commission on the 25th. Council will take it up. It'll be introduced to them over the next month, beginning tomorrow. And they will take first and second reading actions on December 10th and 17th. Before that happens, well, we're now in the 60-day commerce review period, but we are expecting an appeal of the final EIS. The appeals are due this Friday, the 18th. We are expecting an appeal of that. That will go to the hearing examiner. It's already been scheduled for November 7th, and that appeal period and process will come to completion, oh, I want to say about, you know, mid to late November. If the appeal is upheld, then of course that's going to put everything to a stop in terms of East Monroe. The other two would continue on. If the appeal is not upheld, if it's found you know, not to be have any basis for it for appeal, then the city continues on. Commission, you do your actions. The council takes action. After that point, after December 17th, there is an appeal period actually to the Growth Management Hearings Board that would begin December 23rd and go for 60 days. So all the, and no appeal can be filed to the state until final action has been completed. So there's an interim appeal of the EIS and potentially an appeal of the comp plan amendments or amendment after the first of the year.
Commissioner Demarest?
I think Commissioner Jensen was first.
Commissioner Jensen.
Just a question on the schedule. I know originally the public hearing, the documents I had received suggested we were trying for the 28th.
Right.
And it still had the recommendation date on the 25th of November. With the hearing date moved, if something necessitated having our recommendation date also slide to our next meeting, can the council still pick their thing up on the 10th and the 17th, or do they have to wait a certain amount of time after our recommendation?
There really is no minimum time between recommendation and council action. That would be the last meeting of the commission in November.
Right. And it would not be if we had to go into December.
It would not be a meeting prior to December 10th, which is council's first action. Unless it was held on, a commission meeting was held on December 2nd. But I have no idea what may come out of a public hearing, but there will be a period of time to make some changes and to consider those changes at the 25th meeting. If for some reason there are substantial changes that the commission wishes to take, then the worst case is we meet the first Monday in December for recommendation. That's pushing it right to the limit.
Are we obligated to meet before or to recommend or whatever before the 10th? Or could they start their process on the 17th and following their first? Could their first reading be on the 17th instead of the 10th?
No, the 17th is actually the last council meeting of the year. And the council the commission does need to make a recommendation, a forward recommendation. The commission can choose not to forward a recommendation, but commission action is required. Approval, denial, or no recommendation. And then council can take action.
Commissioner Demarest?
Paul, I understand the constraints of time, but is there, if for no other concern than public perception, is there an issue with scheduling the hearing on a state and federal holiday?
Not that I know of.
I'm not necessarily talking legally, but just as far as how it appears.
Not that I know of. It's not a common holiday. I'm not sure what all closes on Veterans Day. I've only been off on Veterans Day for, 6-7 years.
Certainly more closes on Veterans Day than on Columbus Day.
Which is today.
Yes.
Yeah. I would rather see us move it up a week and be on a regular day than schedule it on what's a holiday. Yeah.
Actually, at this point, the 11th is the earliest that it could be held on a Monday.
It couldn't be on the 4th?
No. The public notice wouldn't be. We wouldn't have 15 days. We have an issue with our code that we've not changed that would make the public notice process a little easier by changing it. One minor tweak. But the 11th is the first date that it could be considered. Could hold it on, I don't think we want to push it out much farther. We could hold it on the 18th, for example. That only gives us a week between the 18th and the 25th.
Is there a problem with doing that? Only having a week between the 18th and the 20th?
I think that's too tight.
You think so?
Yeah.
What if we did the 18th and then the 2nd, I think you were saying?
That's a possibility. Makes me nervous that it's getting really tight with council.
Yeah.
But it's a possibility. what I can do is check if there's any, I don't believe there's any legal aspect preventing a meeting on a holiday, but I can check, or to see if Veterans Day qualifies as one that legally cannot be held, but to my knowledge, it's not a problem, but we can check on that.
Well, that's why I put it in terms of public perception rather than legal question.
Yeah.
I would just hate to see it impact attendance or participation because of any confusion that might arise out of it or scheduling. So, I'm here that day.
I don't think people go out of town or have a barbecue or, you know, like, it's not really a family. You get a day off of school and post office, I know. But.
Just a question. Thank you.
Okay.
Carry on.
Anything else? Okay. Paul?
Okay. East Monroe. Give you a little bit of history, a little bit of update on this. We talked about this last year quite a bit, but for everyone's benefit, this is, as you know, a proposal to change from limited open space to general commercial. Both the comp plan, land use, and the zoning, and the final EIS we are using to consider how to proceed with this or how to form a recommendation on East Monroe. I mentioned the appeal period and the 60-day period. In terms of history, this goes way back to, 1970 when it was first annexed. It's been through, three submittals since 2004 that basically dealt with it's the same basic application, but the land areas changed. And of course, this time we're going back a third time with a full EIS since it was the amendment was disqualified last year with that phased EIS. Existing, if you can see the blue outline is the property that is being proposed around here, this blue area. It's all limited open space. Proposed is the general commercial. What has changed is that this parcel was in the previous application, the one that was considered last year. A quick summary of on-site impacts. And we've had some discussion of this also. But there are type 1 streams and slough area. There are wetlands. There's a critical areas map that's coming, but wetlands throughout the area where you would expect along the river channel. Shoreline exists, is designated roughly in this area, the southwest part of that stream area. Natural growth protection areas is within the wetlands and the wetland buffer areas. Steep slopes, as we've heard about along this slope up to the residences above, and floodplain. It's currently not in the 100-year floodplain, but the EIS was done, as you might recall, on the basis that it is in the 100-year floodplain, since that's the direction that FEMA's headed. It's not officially adopted that way by the city, but it was considered as 100-year floodplain. Okay, critical areas map. Stream, wetlands, native growth protection areas, buffers, all of this accumulates to leave these two developable or buildable areas, total of about 11 acres out of 42. Now here's a little better illustration. 43 acres total, a little over 11 acres that in at least one scenario can be developed. And the EIS, of course, talks about all of the various potential impacts and how they're proposed to be mitigated. There gets to be a fine line between this as a non-project action, not a specific development proposal, or a project action And I know there was a lot of questions from many different people in the EIS about mitigation measures that could not be fully defined without a project, any project action. Any proposal is going to trigger a supplemental EIS that would in detail address the specifics of the mitigation, since there would be quantities and levels of impact to work with. Offsite traffic and transportation, we'll come back to that. Aesthetics, noise, those more difficult to measure kinds of impacts that the EIS talked about. Utilities and services, they are available, but it's, you know, almost a mile away into the city. Considering this in terms of cumulative impacts, does this have any relation to other amendments we're considering now? And this is really this is the only development-related amendment in terms of changing the comp plan as opposed to text amendments, but those text amendments also obviously have an impact or a influence on how development occurs and where it occurs. So there could well be, there is a relationship between those. Here's the DOT's roundabout. This is the future bypass heading northwest, Highway 2. There is, in their plans, definitely a roundabout at that intersection. We need to go at least a quarter of a mile from this point east for access into this property. And I'll pop up another map here, DOT map. This would be, this point here would be right here, just past the edge of the subject property. DOT is requiring a frontage road from this parcel across, this would be the edge of the property here. You can see that this edge comes all the way through. With a frontage road and access to Highway 2, and I expect there will be a roundabout here. DOT has not required it exactly, but they're really very strongly in favor of a roundabout here. It would take quite an effort to find an alternative to a roundabout at that point. It's possible, but it would take quite a bit of work with DOT to consider something other than a roundabout. If, for some reason, access is not granted through this property, through some sort of easement, then that means that this access would have to happen off of this property somewhere in this area, which would trigger a different set of issues with DOT. Property would have to be purchased back from DOT, would have to be examined in the context of less than a quarter of a mile. So there are some other issues. But certainly an access easement that would share both properties would make a lot of sense for the property owners. But there will most likely be a roundabout in that situation, in that point, even though the traffic report calls for acceleration, deceleration, left turn lane improvements to meet the impact. That's okay. That's what I've got for East Monroe. Turn back to you, Mr. Chairman. We can have some discussion for any answers and questions.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Commissioners, do we have any questions, discussion topics for Paul on this East Monroe amendment? Commissioner Jensen.
I'm just trying to understand in that intersection point or proposed roundabout, not that one, but the one at this one here. When you're saying that that's at the edge of the property, are we talking the edge of just parcels A through D, or is it also including E? A through E? Yeah, so where is it on this map?
It is right here.
Okay. So it would connect to that adjoining one that is not part of
this round rather than the previous round?
Yes, yes. There would be, in that scheme, there would be a frontage road from this property across and down.
Is it this not that little piece of road, or is that a driveway? Or?
This is a driveway.
Okay, so it's not that.
So that, you know, that could very well be the access point. It would have to be, DOT would like it to be at least at this point, which is, I believe that is a quarter mile from the future roundabout to the west when the bypass intersects. There's an issue of not having legal access from here to here at this point. That would be a, you know, project-related exercise.
Second question I had on the off-site impacts there, and this is something I just heard about the other day that Seattle deals with as they're digging their tunnel. They have to have sensors because they're watching for just minor vibrations in the structures up above. But it makes me think, and I don't recall seeing anything about this addressed in the EIS, and it might not be at this stage. Maybe it's something that comes when there's an actual project, but I would hope it would be part of this one. Would actual construction work, the digging and perhaps even drilling, if putting in posts or whatever structure they're putting, could that create vibrations that could have an impact on that hillside that is probably barely staying? I don't know. But could that be an impact, and should it be addressed because of the shape of that hillside?
That would be a question for a geotechnical engineer. But typically, you know, standard construction operations, limited depth, I have not seen impacts from vibration. I have on large-scale projects where there's quite, you know, pretty serious excavation, freeway construction, that sort of thing. But it's something that could be, perhaps should be addressed in the supplemental EIS when the project action is defined, if there's standard minimal construction. But even that's something that would have to be considered in the geotech report of the natural project.
Last question for now is, just in this overall process or proposal, does the city have to or have the option of considering what the benefit is to the city in taking this action? Since it's not project related, I can see where there's a project is, yeah, do we want that type of commerce or whatever happening? Where it's not project related, one, is that normal? And two, is that, do we need to be considering then at this early stage the benefits to the city?
Well, the short answer is that if it is deemed to be consistent with the comprehensive plan, first of all, and it's supported by goals and policies and direction in the comp plan, that to me would mean that, generally speaking, that it would be viewed as favorable by the city. And the same holds true for the zoning ordinance and municipal ordinances, that if it's consistent with the municipal ordinances, it would be looked upon as favorable. There would actually be no reason to deny it if there is a consistent pattern of consistency with policies, goals, zoning code, that it has followed the process properly, the CEPA process and so forth. The city does not judge economic benefit or feasibility. Now, that's strictly a private exercise. And then, of course, it comes into the political realm of if it is seen as a, do we want this growth? Does the city want this kind of development to occur? And if it's supported by the comp plan, then the short answer is yes.
Now, the city
comp plan and other, right. Other many, many other factors.
I know one area that is an issue with some people is simply roundabouts. And the fact that you said the current plan we have is a regular, I guess, interchange, well, not not a lighted interchange.
Intersection.
Intersection, regular intersection. Does the comp plan address or suggest that it would be desirable for the city to see roundabouts on Highway 2 leaving or entering the city?
Not specifically. The comp plan promotes like policies for connectivity and traffic flow, but also accommodating pedestrians, but it does not get into that level of detail. You know, where there's some language about establishing a gateway at each entry to the city, and a roundabout could be one of many things that need to happen to establish a gateway kind of presence.
But that would be the other roundabout, I would expect.
That would be the other one, right. So,
okay.
But the complex doesn't get into that level of detail.
Okay. Yeah.
I understand your point. It's an interesting point.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Commissioner Demarest?
Thank you. I'm going to dovetail with what Commissioner Jensen was just asking about. Paul, I think it's fair to say, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the phase of the final EIS that that's been gone through and reached or achieved is, for lack of better words, something that's supposedly objective and based on best available science. It really is a review of environmental issues. Right so far?
Yes.
And
it should be based on science, apolitical.
Objective.
Objective. Okay. Yes.
Whereas the comprehensive plan amendment itself, it's really a policy decision, is it not? And by its very nature, a more subjective process?
Very much so.
I think
based on both subjective and objective factors.
Okay. And I think we've got two commissioners that this is their first round of comprehensive plan amendments, I believe. There's criterion that we need to look at in judging a comprehensive plan amendment.
Yes.
And I would imagine that probably at our next meeting you're going to spend some time on those?
Yes.
Okay.
Thought about bringing them tonight, but I thought I'd bring them at the next meeting. I guess it would have been appropriate to bring it tonight. And there are, five or six criteria to consider for any amendment.
Okay. And
a few of those.
I think my last question goes to, we're spending an awful lot of time on the proposed amendments, obviously. Significant amendments to land use, housing, economic development, primarily. But if I understand correctly, this proposed amendment of East Monroe has to be judged as it relates to our currently adopted comprehensive plan elements, not proposed?
This should be considered in terms of whether it's consistent with the comp plan text, in my mind, as proposed for 2013. There's some things in the comp plan that like the description of this area that relate directly to East Monroe.
So when you were answering Commissioner Jensen's question a moment ago, you said that part of that determination of whether we come up with a recommendation, yay or nay, on this issue will go to our comprehensive plan and whether the comprehensive plan elements support such a change. Mm-hmm. So we will be, to make that determination, you're saying that we will actually be using our as yet unadopted comp plan elements?
As a part of the process, yes. The last year, when this was going through the process, it went through with North Kelsey and Downtown Master Plan and East Monroe, I think, were the three last year. Each of those had related amendments to the text of the comp plan, including East Monroe. And that was the same situation where the East Monroe as a proposed land use amendment was being considered in terms of what the comp plan was proposed to be changed. And when that ordinance was disqualified, then it also disqualified the text that was specifically related to the East Monroe Amendment. There were three sections of text related to North Kelsey, related to downtown, and to East Monroe. So since the Langs Amendment went away, so did the related text.
Okay. It just seems a little odd to me that we would be making a recommendation based on something that's not yet formally adopted.
Well, only if it's, in this case, if the commission decides to make some changes to the land use that would put this in, this proposal inconsistent, then that would be a different story.
Okay. And if it's inconsistent with what we currently have adopted, it doesn't matter.
I think that's right. That it's to be considered concurrently with the text amendments.
Okay. The last question I have at this point then goes to that whole gateway issue. There's a lot being made by some that this would be a gateway to the city. That's the way the text amendments read. Someone's going to have to do a really good job of selling me on that concept. When we look at, if you could go back a couple screens to your proposed designation map, there, I see a color on a map that's an island and isolated from the rest of the city.
Here.
And it's what? Right.
That's isolated from.
Right.
Yes. And it will have access off the highway via perhaps a roundabout, and then it will have access back to the highway via that same corridor. And people may choose or choose not to enter the city from that point or to go further into the city. They might stop out there and get their gas or their McDonald's and decide, I don't need to go to Monroe, I'm done. And I just can't see how then that would function as a gateway. So if you could bring some more thoughts on that back, on that particular aspect of it, that would certainly be helpful. That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Rodland?
Can we go back to the property that's supposed to be built on? There.
This one?
The property north of that now. Is that untouchable? All that property down here? Down by the creek there.
Through here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Untouchable. So they
Unbuildable.
You could, or excavating any part of that?
There is some excavation within the NGPA or within the buffer zones around here that would be done for compensatory flood storage.
In other words, they'd be pulling rock out of that to build that area.
I don't know that would be suitable material for fill for this area, but the concept looking in the EIS being that they would excavate some of those buffer areas and then restore them as wetlands at that lower level.
Yeah.
And if the material is useful, it certainly could be used for
it's all little rocks.
Here, but the soil out there, yeah, I think it's, I don't think they'll look deep enough to get to usable material.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioners, anything else? Any other questions, comments on this?
Someone just thinking about
Hanson.
That was just asked, looking at the same map then. So the part that they would be raising up above the 100-year plane is the tan area there, and the part that they would be digging out to give them the compensatory storage is the dark green that's north of that tan area. Is that correct?
It's maybe run through here or perhaps through here.
That's where they would be digging out to provide the storage.
Potentially, yes. This property would any buildings would have to be set at least 1 foot above the 100-year base flood. The parking areas and so forth would not have to be at that same level. Those are floodable, potentially. But buildings would, any building pads and building areas would have to be filled, I'm not sure how many feet, to be built in that floodplain.
But like I say, so they're digging for storage is outside of that 11
yes.
acres.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Anything else? I just had one last comment, and it kind of goes with Commissioner Demers' comment earlier. I think we need a really good definition of what gateway means. This has come up more than a couple times now. And if we had a really good definition of what that really means, then I think it would help. I know it would help me, and I know it would help maybe a couple other commissioners here, not all, as to how we proceed with designating anything as a gateway.
The property owner, including the idea of a gateway in their proposal, are they saying this would be really awesome for the city if you did this because then you could have a gateway here?
No, that's more related to project. Well, it's more related to a project development process.
Okay, so the gateway thing doesn't really have to do with the rezone.
In the past, we considered, in fact, it was a comp plan amendment that has been folded into the 2015 update, city gateways, with the possibility of an overlay zoning that would apply some kind of design standards.
Is that an influencing factor on whether or not, is that part of the criteria for determining whether or not we rezone this property?
No. Not a gateway function. It could be indirectly that we don't have any language in the comp plan now in any specific language for how we treat community gateways or entryways. There's likely to be an element in the 2015 plan that addresses, I'll call it more the urban design elements like gateways, like community design, that will really cement some of that thought, but I don't think it's a measurable factor in consistency with the comp plan.
I would like to see a definition of gateway. We've talked about that before. To me, I don't need to have it in relationship to this thing. Can I ask a couple questions? I've heard some discussion on the city's financial responsibility, and we've talked about it here and there, but if the rezone were to go through, what would be the city's financial responsibility to that property? Just so I can have a clear list.
The city would be obligated to provide, well, to continue to provide services like police, fire. We would not incur any expense for extension construction of utilities. All of the development costs are really the onus of the developer or the developer builder for that property. There are no hard costs for the city in a rezoning like this. If we were, really encouraging development, and this was a more of a viable site in a better location, the city might choose to extend utilities to say develop an industrial park or a commercial retail center. But that's done when there's a property that the city really wants to see developed. And well, the city's done it with North Kelsey, extending utilities and taking ownership on that same kind of concept. But in this case, no. There's no cost to the city. It's really, there's soft costs of dealing with amendments and processing and all that. But no infrastructure costs.
Okay. No. I was wondering what other properties, and this could be something that you bring back. But what other properties in the city limits were zoned limited open space when they were purchased and then rezoned to general commercial? I imagine there, hopefully, this isn't the first time this has come up.
Okay, you can check on that.
Yeah, that's all for now. Thank you.
Commissioner Ladman?
In the past, we've always had a project before something like this started. We've had Freddie Meyer store come in and said, we want some property, can we do this for more? I don't see anything like that happening here. I don't see anybody come out and saying, we want to put this kind of a store in or project. I'd like to know. I just don't see it.
Commissioner Dirksen?
This is already in the city limits, right? Annexed in.
Yes,
so what are our responsibilities to that property at this point?
At this point?
Mm-hmm.
Police, fire. We do not serve with any utilities. I mean, they're, power and phone and so forth, cable, are not city utilities, but we do not provide sewer or water, but basic services, garbage, police, fire, solid waste. I'm not sure what else there is.
Commissioner Gershon, I'm Jim Rush.
We'll start with Dee.
Of course.
Paul, all along it's been pretty emphatic that there would not be a situation in which any public dollars would be spent to bring needed infrastructure to this property. And yet, the economic development element, at least as it's proposed, says that the city could decide to spend dollars to provide infrastructure to an area of town to facilitate and enhance development potential for something to that effect. Based on that language in the comp plan element, assuming it gets adopted that way, a future council could say, yeah, we think the sewer should be out there and pay for it. Could they not?
They could. I think that policy in general is a good policy, that if there is a land that clearly needs to be developed or should be developed to the benefit of the city or in the city's interest, then I think that policy does establish a means or the possibility for extending services if we really want to encourage development. And it's not happening without some kind of incentive to the private market. But in this case, this is a pretty unique case. And there would have to be a pretty serious cost-benefit analysis of whether the city would benefit from undertaking pretty serious cost to extend to this particular site. But in general, I think it's a good policy to have in the books.
Thank you.
And that could happen whether it's rezoned or not rezoned, correct? If it stayed limited open space, that still could be a possibility.
That's a good one. I would say no, since there is no purpose or reason to extend utilities to a limited open space property.
But you could still build a church out there. Could be a very large church,
right.
Or it could be, like I said before, could be a health club.
Right.
So, I mean,
some industrial.
If it was a church, then the city would not have any interest in running sewer and water out.
But there's no real economic return to the city. It would be a foolish expense. Okay. If the city were to undertake that kind of investment that had no return.
Okay, I'm just trying to clarify.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, it's a judgment call, obviously.
Okay.
But no developer would extend, no private sector would extend utilities without rezoning. And even with rezoning, it has to be proved to be, they prove it to be economically feasible.
Yeah. Commissioner Jensen?
on that subject, does Extended Utilities grant any waivers to the otherwise restrictions on some of the off-limits areas of building? Does somebody have like the right to say, hey, I can have electricity, so I can put it here even if it's wetlands or it's a sensitive area?
You can provide essential public facilities. Extending utilities to private development would be considered an essential public facility in that sense. They could, if they, and I'm sure they indeed would, go through critical areas like wetlands for, say, extension utilities, they would have to be fully mitigated. And most likely, you know, in other land area or somehow mitigated in the same area.
Right,
but there's no get out of jail free card with that.
Okay. They'd have to go through the same hoops. Just if a developer was paying for that, or if the city was doing that.
If the city was extending those utilities at site, I think the city would have to jump to the same groups.
Okay. And then looking very, very, very far into the future, someday, I hope, US 2 is a divided highway. How would that impact access to this property?
The roundabout would have to be designed to conform to a four-lane highway. That's part of DOT's response.
Okay.
It has to be within that. It has to consider the four-lane, ultimate four-lane cross-section.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah,
one more thing. Commissioner Dorchin.
I'm just trying to get this all clear in my head because you went through this once right before I got on the commission. Who is requesting that this be changed? I mean, we seem to be spending an awful lot of time on a project that there's a big part of the town that doesn't want this happening. Who's asking for this? Is it something the city wants to do, or is it the person that owns the land that wants this done?
It's the property owner is the Heritage Baptist Church. I believe I have that right.
Okay.
They've owned this property for several years, and they are the applicant. It's a citizen initiated amendment.
And they have nobody that's they're looking at this point that is interested if it gets changed.
That I don't know. I assume that they do or have. I think they have in the past.
Okay.
But today I really have no idea.
I know we aren't personally meeting, we don't look at this from a financial aspect, but it still I have the question of if this zone is changed, that I would expect that would have an impact on the property taxes that are levied.
Yes.
And I take it that's not something we would be concerned with if the property owner is prepared to pay higher taxes, maybe they sell it to somebody else, but if they don't, can't find a buyer, don't pay the taxes, what happens then? You know, because now it's higher taxes. Does it go into some default? Does that become a problem for the city that's now a concern of ours?
Well, of course, if taxes go unpaid, you know, eventually it would end up in the hands of the lender, if there is a lender.
Paul, I can jump in on that if you'd like.
Yeah,
basically, if you, Steve, fail to pay your taxes for 4 years, the county assessor can choose to foreclose on your property for non-payment.
Right.
And the same could happen here. The impact on the city in the meantime is that they don't get any share of the tax revenues. There's no money coming in.
There would be backlog money for on lien once the property was sold.
Well, once the assessor forecloses on a piece of property, the lien is satisfied by them having taken the property.
Right, but I assume they resell the property to sort of get the money to cover that lien ultimately, don't they?
Jeff, the lien is satisfied by taking the property, isn't that?
No, satisfied by a sheriff's sale of the property after it was taken.
Okay.
If there's adequate proceeds to pay the taxes, then the balance outside the cost goes to the property owner.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else? I don't see anything else, Paul. So
okay,
we can move to the next item. We're going to take item C here, the CPA 2013-D, school mitigation fees, and ZCA 2012-09, school mitigation fees.
Okay. School impact fees. As you know, the commission considered this last year, last fall, and this amendment was being taken through the amendment process by itself, not cumulatively with the other two amendments. Because as a budget-related amendment, it could be acted on independently. But council did not take action. They chose not to make a decision on the impact fees last fall, so it is now back with these other two amendments to be addressed before the end of the year with these other two. So what this is about, and I think this is fresh to you, Steve, and Diane, were you here when this was? Okay. This is about, first of all, amending the capital facilities chapter in the comp plan. It's basically taking out regulatory language and discussion of how the impact fees are determined, or it's the impact fee, I think, is now defined in the comp plan. That goes back to that same exercise we went through with North Kelsey and downtown about not having regulatory language in the comprehensive plan. It's a policy document, not a regulatory document. So it includes revisions to that element. And in that same context, changes to Chapter 20 of the Municipal Code in revising language there to in how the impact fee is determined and setting the discount rate. That's being done in the code, not in the company. But what this is related to are the Monroe School District's 2012-2017 capital facilities plan, which, you know, of course, deals with people forecasts and facility needs for the next 5 years and sets impact fees. Same with Snohomish School District. Snohomish is now within the city limits with the Roosevelt Road area. So we have their 2012-17 facilities plan to adopt as well. These are typically adopted every other year is when these are put together. So that is a part of this exercise is to normally, it would be an adoption of the school district plan without other changes, but in this case, we're considering changes to the discount rate, which triggers the capital facilities element for the city and the municipal code. What it's about is that, I'm not sure of all jurisdictions, but most jurisdictions take the school's impact fee, say it's $1,000, and they discount it 50%. So they charge $500 impact fee. That fee is collected by the city and then passed on to the school. We're basically a receiver and a sender of the monies for that. Monroe has a 25% discount. So we collect more in school impact fees than most other jurisdictions. On a $1,000 impact fee, we collect $750. And what was brought up last year was changing the impact fee discount to 50%, which would increase or decrease the amount of money going to the school, would decrease the amount of money put out by a developer for school impact fees on residential. It does not apply to commercial property, just to residential. That's what this is about. So when you think about the impact fees, I put together this little summary. Single family in one category, duplex, townhouse, multifamily, two more bedroom multifamily in another category. And you can see that this top part up here, being the Monroe School District, the impact fees that were charged in 2008 and 10 and what they are proposing, what they would currently charge, if we adopted the 2012-17 plan from Monroe School District and adopted the 50% discount, it would change from this $2,900 to about $2,000. This is the 25% impact. This is the 50% discount impact fee. In terms of multifamily, it would decrease from $4,900 to $3,172. So in this case, you know, single family impact fees are going down. Multifamily impact fees are going up. Ralph Yingling is here. He might have a couple comments about that. In this Nehomish district, they had a bond issue. Was that in 2010? That basically wiped out impact fees. But in their 2012-17 plan, they're coming back with a $1,344 impact fee for single family. In Monroe, it would be $1,344 at a 25% discount. If this passes, then that's reduced to $896, or about $900. So it's the same, basically simple math. Do we discount at 50% or 25%? One side says if we discount it, if we lessen the cost of the developer, it will be an incentive for further development. And the school district, of course, is wanting to get as much funding as it possibly can in these impact fees. So they're obviously opposed to a reduction in our, or increase in our discount rate. And I think that's all I have for that. So that's quite a bit of material. I know, and we went through this last fall. The commission had forwarded a recommendation of approval. I did not check the vote count. It was not unanimous. There were six of us at that. I believe it was 4-2. I did find the minutes from last fall, but I had a chance to actually check on the vote. But the recommendation forwarded was to change the discount rate from 25% to 50%. In other words, decrease fees to the builder, decrease fees to the school district.
Commissioner Tuttle.
Thank you. Who sets the impact fees to begin with?
The school district, in their capital facilities plans, they go through a methodology, this whole process to estimate impact fees based on what their five-year needs are going to be. And that plan, one of the outcomes of that plan is the actual number. In this case, well, pick a number. The 100% full impact fee number.
So the school district sets that. So why is there a discount in the first place? How come they say they need a number, and why don't we charge 100% of what they say they're needing based on their formula? I don't think I understand why there's a discount.
That's a good question. I don't have the answer. But if we could ask Ralph, would you have any input on that?
I do. You want me up here? Sure.
I don't know how formal you are, but you need to check in and get my hand address.
I think it would be good for you to give your name and address, just for the record.
My name is Ralph Yingling. I live at 2371 950th Street in Monroe, just outside the city limits. I'm the director of facilities for Monroe School District. Your question, Commissioner, was who sets the fees? The school district calculates the fees using a prescribed formula that comes to us from the county. The actual fees should be set by the city council as a matter of the municipal code. So the council has the final say on what the fee will be.
The county gives you a formula.
Correct.
And then you figure out the number on the formula, and then you give that to the council.
We put that under capital facility plan, goes to the planning commission, goes to the council for adoption, and then the fees are controlled by municipal code.
Do you know why there's a discount?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And it goes back to the early 90s. And at that point, the Growth Management Act was being implemented. Discount fees were just beginning to start in the county. We sat through many meetings with the county and the master builders, and we calculated fees back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And in reality, what happened is an agreement was reached between the county, the schools, and the master builders to come up with a discount fee that they felt would bring the fee down to a level that was acceptable to the builders so we wouldn't have a lawsuit.
Okay.
It's not a good explanation, but it's what happened in reality.
Well, I just wonder why the fee just isn't set at a realistic number instead of picking a discount percentage.
The fee calculates what it costs us to house a child for a certain period of time.
Okay.
And it's discounted to something that was acceptable to everybody at the time.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
That's
all the questions we have for Commissioner Demarest.
Ralph, nice to see you again. I understand Ralph would have been at a board meeting tonight if he wasn't here, so.
You guys saved me.
Yes. You say that the calculation is stipulated by the county.
Correct.
They must get it from somewhere.
It is, again, during that initial negotiations, they came up with a growth management form, Growth Management Act compliant fee, and they have a very prescriptive, it's called Appendix 7, that lists every portion of the formula you must use.
Okay. Can you see any reason at all as to why the City of Monroe would want to incorporate that formula verbatim in our ordinance?
I can't.
I can't either. Thank you. I think that's it for my questions for Ralph right now. I do have a question, Paul, for you.
I got a question.
Oh.
That's how we're doing this.
Commissioner Jensen?
I just want to make sure I understand this then. The school district couldn't just inflate these fees if they wanted to overcome too steep of a discount. The fees are capped by this formula or by law even?
Right. The fees start with how much space you have in school, what projected enrollment is going to be, how many kids are going to come, where are you going to house them, how many kids do you get out of each house, in fact, each type of house, and then you go through this giant calculation. It includes taxes, it includes what the OSPI contributes to us. It's a three-page formula by the time you're done. And you can't really fudge it.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioners, any other questions for Ralph? Thank you, Ralph.
Okay, I do have some comments I'd like to make when your discussion's over.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Commissioner Demarest, you had a question?
I do. Paul, the table on page 10 of the draft redlined ordinance, impact fee schedule exemptions, section 20.07.100.
Which attachment?
That's in the redlined ordinance.
Page 10?
Yes. Now, Mr. Sherwood told me that he understands the point of this table, but I'm struggling with it.
Put it up on the screen?
No.
No, I mean no. From the...
It's this one.
Yes.
Can you put it up on the screen?
Oh, can you put it up on the screen?
Yes.
Sure. Finish your presentation.
I think he was done.
He was done.
There was no more slides.
No more PowerPoint slides on the school. Okay, here we go.
Yes.
I might be able to zoom in a little bit. Okay. Whoops.
The other zoom.
There section entitled exemptions has this table on it, and these numbers match what you did put in your staff report as what the impact fees would be if we were at a 50% discount. So are these in fact the mitigation fees or impact fees that we would be looking at under the 50% discount?
Yes, these are the 50% numbers.
Then why do we call them exemptions?
Actually, I found it odd that this table is the first part of the exemptions section in the chapter.
Well, perhaps that helped contribute to my confusion.
Because Beagle's not to talk about exemptions. This sets the table, so to speak, for these numbers. But I'm not sure it belongs under exemptions. That's where it has been in the past.
Well, then, maybe it needs to be re-looked at as far as how it's structured, because it certainly confused me.
Okay. We'll pursue that. Along with the, whether the methodology should be included in the municipal code if it's defined by the county and set by the school district, it may be redundant.
And
at this level.
And it seems to me that it would be. I was the one who voted against this last time it was in front of us for a couple different reasons. One, I just don't think that belongs in there. I don't see the purpose of it other than using up paper and confusing people perhaps. But more importantly, we collect mitigation fees for one other outside entity, don't we? And that would be state DOT.
We do for DOT if it's more than 25 additional trips, peak hour trips, triggers impact fees, but there are other cases where impact fees are triggered. I think on commercial projects at from the state level.
And do we tell them how much those fees should be?
I can't answer that. Don't know.
And it goes to my
my challenge with this in general, us trying to tell the school district how much their fees should be that they determine they need. It seems backwards. And philosophically, I just have a hard time agreeing with that. Now, that said, I do think that we should be consistent, because a kid that moves in or a family that moves in outside the city limits, Ralph, in my mind, has the exact same impact as a kid that moves into the district within the city limits. And I have a hard time justifying myself how it is that we would be charging a different discount rate than what Snohomish County charges. One district, one rate. One district, one discount. So those are my concerns with this. I also think that we should perhaps look at how we structured 20.07.075. It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But that's a fairly minor point. I don't know how many times we need to say that we're not going to go along with what the school district says in their capital facility plan with regard to fees. We've got it in here, I think, three or four different times, and it starts to get a little tiresome and redundant in my mind, and probably unnecessary. So those are my comments at this point. Paul, I think you had a response to something I said. Looks like you want to try to respond to something I was saying.
Oh, no, I'd like to ask Ralph a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
Does the county use the same 50% discount fee, discount rate?
The county uses a 50% discount rate. And in fact, in our capital facility plan, you'll see it. There's two different fees. There's one is a 50% discount rate for the county, and there's one for a 25% discount rate for the city, which was imposed by the city council a number of years ago. They said, you aren't asking for enough. We are going to pass a 25% discount rate.
But they come from the same number.
They come from the same number.
Yes.
The actual cost of housing those children are double or 25% more than the fees you see.
Thank you.
I think I had the same confusion and the questions in my head when we went through this first time last year. But one of the questions I have tonight is, why, do you remember why City Council refused to take action on this at the time they were supposed to?
I know there were questions, as I recall, about whether there was any real documentation that enacting this lower impact fees would indeed attract additional development.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I know that was one of the issues. I don't recall really any of the specifics. I can do some checking and bring you back some information at the next meeting. But they basically deferred a decision until it was coming back now. I'm not sure if they consciously deferred knowing that it was coming back at the end of the year, but they didn't have enough information or enough of a comfort level to make a decision.
Yeah. And the other confusion I have, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is that why would the county say, this is what we feel it costs to put a child in a school, and then come back and say, this is what we're going to discount it? Why wouldn't they just give you a real number right up front and say, this is what it is, and be done with it, instead of having all these silly discounts and having, you know, everybody choose a number and go off on their own? If we're going to have it, let's have it one way and be done with it. That's, you know, if the county's given 50% discount, evidently the county feels that maybe the number they gave you up front was too much. And then we say we're going to give a discount. It doesn't make any sense. Commissioner Demarest?
Well, the formula takes hard numbers into consideration. And I think it's fair to say you have no control up front what that end result number is going to be. And so they just looked at that number. They came out as a result of that formula in negotiation with, as you said, the Master Builders Association to avoid a lawsuit or mitigation fees or impact fees. They agreed to cut it in half.
That still doesn't make, you can say that over and over and over. To me, it doesn't make sense.
So are you using projected numbers of students or actual numbers of students?
We use projected numbers, and we use two different sets. We use one that's called the OSBI Office to Project Public Instruction Numbers, which is a very narrow look. And then we also are mandated to use the OFM numbers that we get from the county. This fee is based on the OFM numbers.
Rob, can you put something in words that maybe help my mind a little bit and get my mind wrapped around this a little bit better?
I think David hit it right on the head, because when we sat down and they came up with the original number, and I'm assuming you're talking about why it's discounted 50%.
Yeah.
When the county and the school directors at that time sat down with the master builders and went through it, it reminds me very much of today's Congress. They were back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth, and threats, and handshaking, and pounding on the table, all those things that go on. And the decision was, we were either going to get a reduced fee, or we were going to be all of us in court. And the decision at that time was by the county to offer a 50% discount. Was that acceptable to the schools? Was that acceptable to master builders? And that's the way the formula came out with the discount built in.
Okay. Now that explanation did help me somewhat. But it's still in my mind. You know, I'm an engineer, so you know, everything has to be, you know, we got precision.
It's political thinking and not linear thinking.
Yeah, it's precision. And in my mind, it's something that just, you know, if it should be this, let's make it that, instead of fooling around with discounts.
It was arbitrary.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Ralph. It is. Commissioner Demarest.
The other concern that I had with this, as I reflect back on it, was that one of the motivations behind this is that currently we address this in our comprehensive plan element. And the thought was, as I recall, Paul, that it doesn't belong there, it needs to be in an ordinance, a zoning, or in an ordinance that can be changed more easily. Now, the school district includes it in your two-year capital facilities plan, right? What document is this included in?
The capital facilities plan, the CFP.
And that's
it's basically written every 2 years, but it runs in this case 2012 to 2017.
Okay. So the school district, in order to have some predictability, has a fairly firm number. Now, if we move it into our zoning documents or ordinances, the city's got the ability to change it on a political whim. Basically. And
possibly, yes.
And the concern that I had there is that it undermines the predictability that the school district has in the way of impact fees that they will be having coming in from development looking forward over a period of time. Now, if our ordinance just said, you know, discount this much and we will only change it or look at changing it when the capital facilities plan gets updated from the school district, we have a problem with that, but it doesn't say that. So it makes it much less of a predictable thing for the folks that need the dollars when there's growth. So just one of the concerns and area concerns I have with it.
Right, the comp plan capital facility element on page 5 explicitly says that the city declines to adopt proposed impact fee schedules in the school plan. And we'll establish, the city will establish that discount percentage in this zoning code chapter, or this municipal code chapter.
I was waiting for the final finish.
So it does certainly, yes, it does rightfully, I believe, transfer the amount of the fee or the, you know, the actual calculation of the fee to the municipal code, not the comp plan. That policy does pretty explicitly set forth that that it will be determined in the code. We're not going to, it almost says that the city may change. There could be a different policy that perhaps gives a little more predictability, that you know, a civil policy would be, for example, that the city of Monroe will basically follow the county policy in terms of discount rate, or you know, will continue to work with the county in applying the established discount rate. Now that policy means that the code should be consistent with that. In other words, the code would be 50%. If the code was 25%, then it would be inconsistent with the comp plan. Or if it was 75%, it would be inconsistent with the comp plan. I guess it works both ways.
Commissioner Sherwood?
Yeah, I believe I apprehend the concept of impact fees. I also apprehend the fact that we are supposedly now living in a equitable and socialist society. So I have a scenario to, you know, flesh this out. Monopah Kettle raised a family of six kids over here, you know, a couple blocks away. House they added to over the years. And they say, I'm tired of walking up and down the stairs. So they come to Rick Hansen, who's building Ramblers over in Rose Lane Estates. And Mr. Hansen has to write a check for $24,302.96 for the building permit, of which, at least right now, he had to pay $3,767 in school impact fees. But Monopah Kettle move into this house and they don't have any kids. And therefore they don't have any impact. You understand we're talking averages. That creates a vacuum in Monopah Kettle's old house, and let's say a family of six with four kids moves in, and they don't pay a dime. And if you sat down with them at closing and said, sorry, you gotta give $4,000 to the school impact fees. That would not be pretty. It would blow the deal, right? But that is what we're doing here. And so I am reiterating what I said, I think, when we went through this in round one, that the whole thing is inequitable on its face, in all its language, in its application. And I agree with Commissioner Christensen that it really would behoove everybody, if we're going to stick people with these fees, that it be equitable. And I don't see that in anything we're doing, whether we're 25%, 50% discount. It is unconscionable that a builder has to pay $24,000 to pull a building permit, and the homeowner has to pay $150 a month ad infinitum to support bad planning and execution on the part of a variety of public institutions.
Commissioner Tuttle?
Commissioner Sherwood, I'm just asking if we're saying the fee is $4,000, but we're going to give them a 50% discount, why don't we just set the fee at $2,000? That's just the part I don't get. I don't understand saying some places it's 25, some places that, why don't we just pick a hard number? And it sounds like the council has the power to do that. So I just don't understand the whole discounting thing in the first place. Not that I don't think it should. It shouldn't be, the fee shouldn't be detrimental to building. No, I agree. And it shouldn't be detrimental to homeownership. It shouldn't be unfair, but I just don't, I'm not really comfortable with the idea of saying, well, here's a number that they should pay, and we're going to deduct it this much, and somewhere else is going to deduct it that much, and that is an arbitrary determination. Why not just set a fee? That's all.
Commissioner Demarest?
I think the option for the 50% or for a percentage discount is simply that every 2 years, that number can change. Your mitigation impact, you might go up, it might go down based on that three-pay formula.
That slide is gone now, but it does change every 2 years.
And so by having percentages, the city's fee that they're collecting flows with those changes without having to go to necessarily amend the ordinance each time.
Okay, I don't necessarily think it would be bad to talk about it and reevaluate it every 2 years either, especially since I'm learning that this whole practice started in the early 90s and we're nowhere close to that now. It's a practice that just got put into motion and has been continued without review. So.
And we do talk about it every 2 years when we're asked to incorporate the school's capital facility element into our comprehensive plan.
And we determine the discount that is applied for 2 years.
Well, we used to, in that the discount was included in the school's capital facility plan, and we just incorporated that by reference, and the discount got applied. Now we're saying let's take the discount calculation out of that arena. We're going to accept the capital facilities plan from the school, but we're going to disavow any liability toward the fees that they're asking for in there. We're going to move that discussion to our zoning code, our municipal code, and determine whether we want to give them 25% or 50% discount or whatever it might be. I don't have a problem with that if we put some parameters on it that said, look, there's going to be some predictability that comes along with this, and that within 90 days of each two-year cycle as it comes forward, the city will make any changes, if needed, to the fee schedule that's a part of the Monroe Municipal Code here, and then they will stay at that level until the next time we go around again. And that way the school district at least would have predictability, knowing that for the next 2 years, this is going to be the fee that we're going to get from the city of Monroe. It may not be what we wanted. It may be a 50% discount instead of a 25% discount, but it is what it is, and we've got it for 2 years. As it is now, midstream, a year down the road, 9 months down the road, the council can come in and change that fee to a different percentage. And the school district is having to reshuffle again based on different fees coming in than were anticipated.
Yeah, I understand that. I just think if you're going to sell something all of the time on sale, you should just lower the price to the sale price. I don't really care what that price is. Could be a lot lower to balance it out for homes that are occupied by people with kids and homes that aren't. It just seems like a silly practice.
Commissioner Jensen?
I wanted to ask Commissioner Sherwood, you, in your example, I want to take this a step further. Take that family with 6 kids that moved into an existing home and didn't have to pay anything, and you're suggesting, suppose, fee or tax was applied that they didn't have to pay when they moved in at closing. They had to pay $3,000-$4,000, whatever. Then that family, his job changes, he moves out, another family moves in with kids. And if your example, they would pay again, even though the impact is zero to the school, they've already adapted for the previous family's kids. And that can happen over and over and over. Every time a family moves into an existing house where there was previously had kids, the new family moves in, they got kids, they would keep paying that fee over and over. To me, that wouldn't be equitable either.
That
the fee is paid by a new builder one time.
Right, I'm taking your example. You were looking for a more equitable.
If it's paid one time, then it's paid one time, whether it's an older house or a newer house. And what you're saying indicates the complexities and difficulties of making this process equitable.
Right. And so I guess if we're stuck with something that's not perfectly equitable, it would seem like one fee per new house would be the most equitable, because once that's paid...
It's decidedly prejudicial. It prejudices against one class over another, a new homeowner over an existing homeowner. Plain and simple, undeniable, supported by the facts. That's the case. I agree with Commissioner Tuttle that if we said, okay, so that everybody knows, you know, and the builder knows, and everybody else knows, say it's going to be $2,000 per unit. So that if your calculation, which you're forced apparently to follow, comes out at $7,000 one period of 2 years, we multiply whatever number we have to percentage by 7,000 to get 2,000. If the next go around is 5,500, then the discount is higher, so that it always ends up being $2,000. And if you really want to be equitable, you can do that. And indeed, bringing it into the code at least allows for that response to occur on a timely basis. That way the builder knows and you know, everybody knows what the fee is going to be. That doesn't make it any more equitable, but it does provide some liability in regards to the whole community knowing what the fee will be year in and year out.
So you'd like to make the discount adjustable or variable to keep the fee a flat amount?
Certainly they could do that. It would consider, I mean, require a council action every biennium. You said it's, I see the figures in here for every 2 years, so it went from 4708, 3767, 2976. So it does change every 2 years,
correct? That is correct.
Okay.
You normally have over the past, I'm going to say 20 years, the first couple of years it was very steady, and then it began to fluctuate.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Demarest?
Paul, I think you're looking for some direction from the commission, are you not?
Always.
I could get behind this idea if it was done with a few things in mind. I could certainly see taking the fee, which I think needs to be a percentage in order to be reflective of the school district's determination of needs as determined by that process, as compared to an arbitrary dollar amount. I can see that being taken out of the comprehensive plan element. The draft that's in front of us says that will happen. We're going to adopt a capital facility plan for the school district, but disavow any fees that are in it, so to speak, and reserve that for the Monroe Municipal Code. I think if the comprehensive plan element on our part said we're going to do that, and went on to say that the council shall within 80 days, 120 days, I don't care, of adoption of the capital facilities plan for the schools, determine for the subsequent two-year period a discount rate and incorporate that into the Monroe Municipal Code. I wouldn't have a problem with that. It would create for predictability for the school district. They might not like the discount if the city moved from a 25% discount to a 50% discount, but it would at least be predictable for that two-year period. I think we've got to move, from my perspective, we need to move away from this idea that the city can change its fee whenever they want. It's not our fee. It's the school district's fee. We're caught in the middle. And I think that is one way that we could accomplish that.
Good move.
I personally think that would be very equitable. Commissioner Dirksen?
I agree with that. That it would be a consistent fee at all times, whether it's the 25 or 50%. my one question is so this fee pays for what versus what I pay in my taxes?
The mitigation fees can only be used for portions of capital projects. It can buy land. It can buy temporary housing, portables. And in fact, we bought some portables just this last summer, and it can help build schools. And it can modify space to house more kids. That's it.
What does the taxes do that I pay out of my house?
That helps pay for everything else. There's two types, actually there's three types of taxes. And getting into school finance is just not my area of expertise. But there's what's called an operations levy, which helps pay for operating schools. There's the taxes you pay the state, which is what the state gives us a certain portion of to help operate the schools. And there are capital project bonds, which can only be used for those same things as mitigation fees for buildings, land, new construction.
Commissioner Rodman?
Well, the way this started out back in the growth management days before everything got set up was a new house being built didn't always get on the tax rolls the first year. And so this was what we need to get it on the tax to get school fees for the first time, first shot. There was a lot of mistakes being made back then. I know I was one of them. I was on the board. But we couldn't get along with anybody at that time either.
Okay. Commissioner Jensen.
I got some things to actually ask you that I'd like to you, that you could look up for the future. One is, how does Monroe's growth with this 25% discount rate compare to neighboring communities that have the full 50% discount? Is Monroe stunted because of that, or have we been growing faster because of that? And how does, the second point I'd like to find out is how does the school impact fee, kind of got an example from Commissioner Sherwood earlier, but like in official numbers of how does it compare with all the different fees that are paid? How big or how small is this particular fee compared to all the others? And then I would like to see some actual sample data, maybe average home prices, average duplex prices, whatever, that would show how that price would be reflective of both the 25% and the 50% discount, both the sales price and a 30-year mortgage monthly payment effect.
That's a lot to ask. And personally, I think it's a lot to ask the planning commission or planning people right now with all that they have going on.
Mm-hmm. I just don't think some things are going to probably come up.
We did go through a lot. In fact, we had, if I remember right, commissioners, correct me if I'm wrong. We had a builder. One of the guys came in was a builder
from Everett.
And he gave some information on exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I was at one of those meetings, and I know that one of the numbers they gave was flat out a lie. So I thought if we got our own numbers, we'd be better.
I can't comment on that.
Okay, so.
I would be careful as to how deep we need to get into this for this recommendation of City Council. Now, City Council may have those things that they can dig into.
Okay.
But my caution here is overburdening our planners with things that...
Well, when you overburden them.
I understand that, but I'm just trying to caution to make sure that we're asking all the right things and not going off in things that we maybe don't need to right now. So. Commissioner Demarest.
And I agree with all that, but I might offer one thing just from my perspective as a realtor in this community.
and perhaps Mr. Sherwood will jump in as well, but in the last 20 years since we've had mitigation fees, when lots have been created, there have been builders to buy them. When builders have built houses, there have been people to buy the houses. Mitigation fees have been paid all along. And Paul, you commented earlier, one of the reasons that this died last time around was because there was no compelling evidence that, in fact, the mitigation fee discount of 25% was, in fact, having a negative impact on the marketplace. It's a really difficult thing to quantify. We don't have lots sitting out there unbuilt on. If we've had houses in the last few years sitting there unsold, new construction, when there's been some, it's been certainly for many other factors besides just mitigation fees. So I think trying to get an answer beyond that to that question from staff would be asking for an awful lot.
Okay.
Mr. Sherwood, would you have anything to add or counter that one?
I do not.
Just a couple of thoughts or comments. It would be pretty much impossible to compare Monroe to other communities and somehow try and isolate the impact of the mitigation fee or some of the other factor. I think that's been brought up. I think we do have some information. It may not be current, but we have in the past run a comparison of total impact fees, utility and impact fees for new construction. And I think we might be able to get our hands on some of that information as a comparative table. But as I recall, there wasn't anything significant in that, in where we fell with other jurisdictions. But what was I going to say? Lost my train of thought. Sorry.
Commissioner Rylan?
I have a question for Paul. Are we charging mitigation fees for businesses?
No. Just residential.
Okay.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the trend, for the last few years has been that the single family homes are generating less students per unit, and multifamily or units other than single family detached are generating more students per unit. Is that a fair statement?
Generally, in the past, a single family home has generated about 0.66 of a student per home. Could we do a huge demographic study every 2 years and track home sales and how many kids are there? We get about 0.66. That's what we historically got for a single family home, and multifamily homes were much lower. What we've seen in the past several years is a reversal of that, and single family homes are now generating about 0.6 students per home, and the multifamily homes number has gone up. And that's why you see that multifamily home number take a significant jump while the single family home continues to go down. But that's a relatively recent trend.
So I guess, Paul, let me see if I can summarize a little bit. If there was a way of documenting that City Council would adjust that discount based on a certain number, it would equal, the 50% discount or the 25% discount. If it could maintain that number steady, so the school would have some good idea what that fee is going to be when they need it. I don't know how you would document that in that. Commissioner Demers, you have a suggestion?
Well, I see a fatal flaw in that approach. And that is very simple, and it's represented here. Fees have to be trending down on single family homes. Why would we want to lock ourselves into a certain level of fee to $2,000. If, in fact, the school district's coming back every 2 years and saying, we need less.
But they could adjust the discount to make it less.
Well, are we talking about a discount or are we talking about a hard number?
We're talking about they could adjust the discount number to equal that number.
But if the city just adopts a discount, whether it be 25 or 50, 75 or 100, it takes care of that, doesn't it? Because every time the district comes back and says, we determined that our mitigation or impact fee needs to be X number of dollars, it says, okay, we'll stay with our 50% discount, or we'll stay with our 25% discount. End of story. But if you adopt a hard number, then every time you revisit it, you're having to pick a new number. It's just adding a lot of complexity that's not needed.
I thought a little while ago we were all pretty much in agreement saying that having a hard fixed number would be easier for the school to deal with.
My comment was having a percentage that doesn't change in that 2 year period once it's adopted is what I thought was important, because then it gave predictability to the school district.
Commissioner Christensen, if I may.
Yes.
The discount is given to us. It's not something the school district picks. For example, the Snohomish County Code gives us 50% discount. Yeah. The city council has given us 25% discount.
I realize that.
Okay.
Yeah. What I'm trying to do, though, is figure out so that you know that this is the discount that the city's giving you is going to give you this much money. If they could adjust that, you know, to give you that money, then...
I believe the school mitigation fees should change as conditions change.
Right.
Because if we have room for students, we have no need for a mitigation fee or an impact mitigation fee.
Okay.
I do have a statement still at the end.
Okay. All right.
And just my last one. The percentage takes care of it. It just, if the city doesn't change the percentage, the mitigation fee, impact fee, changes with the school district's needs.
Okay.
End of story.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you for the calibration.
So what this comes back to also is that we're considering a change from 25 to 50. It would, you know, ignoring all the other factors, it would be simplest if the city simply adopted the discount rate as set by Snohomish County, which is 50%. And end of story. Now, that's going to impact, no pun intended, it's going to have an effect on the school district if Monroe changes from 25 to 50. So the school's going to be losing money. Mm-hmm. That they've been collecting for, 20-some years.
Mm-hmm. But, again, it goes back to, you know, Commissioner Demarest made the point earlier, you know, the county's at 50%, you know, now you got City Monroe at 25%. The same kids go from the county to the schools that, you know, Monroe mm-hmm. kids go to, and the people are having to pay a different percentage on Commissioner Demers.
Paul, your idea certainly simplifies things. I was just trying to help preserve a little bit of autonomy for the city and the city council to determine independently what they wanted to charge them with or collecting the impact fees for the schools. That's all I was trying to do.
And I agree that it would be, with all that, it would make sense to have that predictability by adopting a discount rate. We're changing a discount rate, you know, before the plan is approved, or as part of the plan approval process, so that it is known what that is going to be for the next 2 years. I don't know if it's ever been changed, and it hasn't been changed in the past since early 90s.
What, the discount rate?
Right.
It was changed.
In Monroe
was at 50% discount rate, and the city council chose to change that to a 25% discount rate and provide the district with more funds.
Do you recall when that occurred?
Long time ago.
Late 90s?
No, it was probably sometime in the late 90s. If I go back and look at the mitigation fees all the way along, you'll see it jump at one point. That's the point.
Right. Okay.
Paul, I hope you have some idea where to go from here.
See what I can put together.
I agree it should be a solid, nice solid number, and I also agree that, you know, the city council, once they set it, can't change it until the next 2 years comes around again. I do definitely agree with that. Okay.
I did have a couple things I wanted to say, and one was to point out the recent trend of the single family home rates going down. Mm-hmm. And that's a factor of all those bits and pieces we take into consideration and factor into the equation. There is a change in the duplex because of that difference in student generation rate that was really surprising to me. One piece of information you may not have is what it cost to provide temporary housing for students. We installed a double portable at Chain Lake to house our called overflow students, and that was for 50 students, and with an LNI compliant double classroom, walkways, electrical hookups, fire alarm hookups, ramp, everything it takes, furniture, is nearly a quarter of $1 million to house 50 students temporarily.
Ouch.
That's what cost us.
Ouch.
That's in this last summer. We opened that portable the day before school.
Is that typical, Ralph?
That is typical. It's a little higher than the normal, but not significantly higher. We had to do some grading walk to make it ADA compliant to get the kids who might be in a wheelchair there. Really, why I came tonight is I wanted to reiterate and just make a few selections from a letter that was sent by the president of our school board to Mayor Zimmerman, the council, and the former chair of the planning commission. And the first letter, the second paragraph says, Monroe School Board is adamantly opposed to any change in the calculation of the school impact fees. These fees are the only time new development contributes to partially offset the impacts of that growth. When families are considering a new home, and these are selected excerpts, anywhere their first thoughts are the school systems. Good schools are good for business. We currently have 34 portables, plus two, we just added this summer, where children are housed. We don't believe, as a school district, that portables are the school classrooms our children need and deserve. It should be noted that over $1 million in impact fees were used to reduce the cost of the new Freelands Elementary School to local taxpayers in our district. The statement has been made by city staff that impact fees may not be needed. OSPI will just give you more dollars when those kids come. Well, that's a true statement. But what it is those dollars are in general operating funds, not capital project funds. So they're used for teachers, they're used for books, they're used for equipment, they aren't used for buildings. And if you have any questions about the capital facilities plan or how it's calculated, give them to Paul and I'll, because I'm the coordinator for the district plan, I'll get answers for them.
Commissioner Demers?
Does the district go back to the county and ask them to decrease their discount every 2 years?
No.
No. So the district lives with that 50% discount?
The county discount fee has been consistent from day one.
So we're really talking, this commission is talking about really two issues, process and discount out. How would you convince me that we should be paying or people, builders, residents in the city of Monroe should be paying more than someone that's just outside the city? How do I justify that?
I don't know that I can answer that question without some thought ahead of time and sit down and think about it.
Maybe you'll be back before us, I suspect.
Maybe.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, Ralph. Did you have a question?
Yeah, what was the reason that the city council raised it after being 50% for so long and then all of a sudden taking it to 25%? Anybody know?
I don't know what to say. It could be a little bit of a political thing.
Okay. Commissioner Tull?
Where else does capital facilities money come from besides mitigation fees?
It can come from two places. One is capital bonds, where we go out to the public and say, we ask you to vote for a bond to build a school, and so much money will come from that. A portion of the taxes you pay to the state for schools goes into their capital construction plan, and they will provide what's called matching funds. And in some cases, it may be 30-40%, but there are a whole lot of things they don't match. School funding is horribly complex. So there's three things you can use to build a school. The bond money from the taxpayers, the state match, which again comes from taxpayers ultimately, and mitigation fees.
Is the bond money a levy?
No, a levy is different. It's for operations and not used for new construction.
Thank you, Ralph.
Sure.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you.
Anything else on this subject? I'll entertain a motion to extend the meeting past 9 o'clock.
I move.
Moved by Commissioner Demarest to extend the meeting past 9 o'clock. I have a second.
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Jensen. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chairman?
Can we take a break?
I think the VA suggested a 5-minute break.
5 minutes?
10-minute break?
Yeah, please.
I'll stop at a quarter.